The Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the First Circuit is now in session. All persons having any business before this honorable court may draw near, give their attendance, and they shall be heard. God save the United States of America and this honorable court. For this session, you may be seated.
Judge, if I may, I wanted to check with Judge Lynch.
Please do.
Judge Lynch, can you hear me and see us?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Good morning, everyone.
Okay, as you can tell, Judge Lynch is with us through the gift of technology, and we're ready to begin.
Thank you so much. At this time, today's cases will be called as previously announced, and times will be as allotted to counsel. The first case today is United States versus Abijah Williams, appeal number 21-1532. Attorney Welch, you can introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your argument.
Good morning. My name is William Welch, and I would like to speak with you this morning about Abijah Williams' guilty plea. Your Honor, would it be all right if I allocated my time to reserve 3 minutes of rebuttal?
You'd be fine.
Thank you. During the Rule 11 hearing that Mr. Williams was involved in, the court asked him, after the prosecution version of events was read, whether it was all true. And he responded, "No, Your Honor." He told the judge 3 times that he wasn't speeding. And then his defense counsel added that he does not believe that he was speeding. It was plain error to accept that guilty plea with that material fact still in dispute.
Okay. Why is that material fact relevant to the elements of the offense? Because it's an issue that could have gone to suppression, but when, as I say, I was a district judge for 15 years, I must have taken hundreds of pleas. You don't go to the elements of the suppression argument. When you plea, there's plenty of case law from the circuit. You go to the court concerns, and you look to Rule 11, and that's what you focus on. This is, you know, so why is this pertinent to the voluntary plea?
Ordinarily, Your Honor, it wouldn't be, but in this case, the district judge entertained it, and he then turned to the government and asked whether they had a witness who would testify about speeding. When they said that they did, he then proceeded and he asked Mr. Williams whether the prosecution version was otherwise correct. So I would submit to this court that when you begin to go down that road, then you would need to resolve that issue. Ordinarily, you wouldn't have to.
But why is that? I mean, don't you ordinarily have to either bring a suppression motion or you don't?
Yes, ordinarily you would.
And in fact, you waive it if you don't.
And that's precisely it. That at the Rule 11 proceeding, the record does not reflect that Mr. Williams knew that he was actually waiving the suppression.
But we have case law. You don't have to know that if you just don't bring it. You can't. If you don't bring a suppression motion, you can't then later say it should have been suppressed.
Ordinarily, I would agree with you,
yeah.
Your Honor. What I'm concerned about in this case, though, is that the record then has the court basically resolving a suppression issue by saying, well, okay, witness, then...
Well, why is that what it's doing? Why isn't it just accepting a plea and on the elements of the offense there is an admission of it? He checks to make sure... I mean, is there going to be somebody who... Is there any factual basis for the plea? Well, if a witness is there who can say, yes, there's a basis, then what's the problem? I'm just not following it.
Well, we don't know what the witness would say. They have a witness who would testify about speeding. We don't know what that witness would ultimately say. And the court would have been in no position to then resolve the question of credibility.
But you would be then asking the court to go on a suppression hearing at the change of plea.
Exactly, which should happen.
And he did, in fact, say, I accept the elements of the offense, I plead guilty, and he knew what the consequences were or what he was exposed to. He admitted enough facts that were pertinent, relevant to the offense. So,
and if the speeding issue had never been raised at all, I would agree with you. But because the issue then was raised, I think the court has to, because it began going down that road, I think the court needs to resolve it. And what the court should have done at that point is...
Counsel, if I may, I believe the factual predicate for your argument is not supported by the record. During the plea colloquy, he was told that by pleading guilty, among other things, he was giving up the right to trial and the right to object to the government's evidence. Furthermore, after he said he wasn't speeding, the issue is not what he says. The issue is whether the officer had a reasonable basis. So the judge quite properly asked the government, will the officer testify to that? And the representation was made in front of your client that the officer was prepared to testify to that. Thereafter, after that, the court asked the defendant whether he, after the entire hearing, he still wished to plead guilty. So the defendant knew at that point that the officer would testify that he was speeding. So doesn't that kind of eliminate even the theoretical argument you are making?
I would submit that it doesn't, Your Honor, because the record needs to show that Mr. Williams understood that in addition to waiving trial rights, he would be waiving this suppression issue because it was...
I'm sorry. The judge told him that he was giving up the right to object to the government's evidence. I believe that's what the transcript shows. Are you saying that beyond that, the judge has to expressly say you are giving up the right to move to suppress evidence?
Ordinarily, no.
But no, not ordinarily. Why is the court's statement, you're giving up the right to object to the government's evidence, not sufficient?
Because that would suggest that object to it at trial as opposed to what Mr. Williams is basically...
No, there's no suggestion of that.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
There is no suggestion of that.
I would submit that because this issue was raised, that it ultimately did not resolve a factual dispute, that Mr. Williams was basically saying, hey, the very origin of this case is in dispute, and the court never addressed that as some of the other courts have. And with that, I'd like to reserve the balance
of
my time. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. At this time, would Attorney Block please come up to the podium and introduce himself on the record to begin?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Benjamin Block on behalf of the United States. I'd like to begin by emphasizing the extent to which the argument the defendant is presenting here on appeal differs from the arguments presented below. Below, the defendant argued that his lack of knowledge about the potential waiver of a motion to suppress was a result of ineffective assistance of counsel by his attorneys. The district court considered that issue and rejected it. And now on appeal, he is arguing that his lack of knowledge about his waiver of potential motions to suppress is the fault of the district court for not explicitly discussing that with him.
So you're suggesting he waived the current argument. It wasn't presented. It should not be presented now.
Correct.
Well, are you saying it's waiver or are you saying it's forfeiture? Because I understood your opposing counsel to say that it was on plain error review.
Yes. He argues forfeiture. I argue waiver, that this is precluded by the Dietz rule, that you cannot switch horses midstream with respect to your legal theories.
Why is it switching horses? Is there an inconsistency between the two?
Yes, there's a meaningful difference between
the two. You said there's a difference. I said, is there inconsistency between the two theories?
An inconsistency.
Well, the ineffective assistance is based on what he's arguing now. He's just arguing for plain error now rather than for an ineffective assistance.
Whenever I make a forfeiture, I've made some argument.
Well, no, typically...
No, I'm... The argument that's forfeited was also accompanied by another argument, right?
The argument...
In general, the way a forfeiture arises is the defendant has made one argument, but not a second argument. Then on appeal, they now make the second argument. But we don't say that's switching horses. We say that's a forfeiture, now you're adding a new argument. Switching horses would be, I argued X, now I'm arguing the opposite, something like that. That would seem like a big problem. But I don't see how, it seems like your approach would make almost any forfeiture a waiver.
I would respectfully disagree. This is his theory of error is that he did not know that he was waiving his motion to suppress. His argument as to why that is the case has changed dramatically from below until now. Before, he argued it was ineffective assistance. Now he argues that it's a result of an error by the district court.
Okay, but suppose we're on plain error, what then?
That's fine. On plain error, there's simply no error here by the district court. The Rule 11 does not require a district court to inquire as to potential legal defenses. And here there was no red flag. The defendant's argument is essentially that the district court should have been put on notice by his objection to the fact that he was speeding as to his desire to file a motion to suppress. That's simply not the case. Defendants not infrequently dispute specific factual language in a prosecution version, but where here it doesn't go to the elements of the offense, it's not material. He continues to refer to it as material fact.
Let me just play that out for a second. Certainly if they quibble with some fact that isn't material to the offense and wouldn't provide the basis for a suppression motion, I can see why it wouldn't be material in any sense. I think the argument here is not that it's material to the offense, but it's material to a suppression motion. So does that cast doubt on whether he's knowing when he's saying that I accept that I'm waiving my right to object to the evidence, if at the same time he's asserting that I'm disputing the evidence in a way that would be material to the suppression motion? I mean, what's your answer to that?
My answer is that is not clear at all from the record. So to the extent that district court had any sort of obligation, it's not and he failed to do it. It was not plain error. I would also submit that it's not error at all because the Rule 11 proceeding is not designed to suss out whether or not the defendant has legal defenses and wishes to.
No, but it's to suss out whether he knows what he's giving up by plea.
And I would submit that the record indicates that he absolutely knew that. The district court made factual findings below that the defendant knew that he was waiving his right to file motions. And the defendant on appeal has offered nothing to indicate that was a clearly erroneous finding by the district court. Turning to, unless the court has...
Let me ask something. I've seen this happen many times. The version of facts is presented by the government, the plea agreement, many times has an introduction, explains kind of like what led up to everything, but many times in practice it spells many things that are unrelated to the offense, like again the background, how the evidence was seized, and again that's immaterial to the elements, but that's normally how the most U.S. attorneys operate, correct, in the plea agreements?
Correct, and those ancillary and contextual...
But they get disputed, not in Massachusetts, but at least in my district, they get disputed all the time. And what I would end up doing was asking, well, forget that version, let me go to the statute. Do you accept X, Y, Z, Z? So my question is, if you accept those particular elements of the offense, everything else is surplus, correct?
Correct. And here the district court could have alternatively excised that phrase for speeding from the prosecution version and have the defendant initial it, and that would have been another perfectly appropriate way to handle it. In this instance, he confirmed with the prosecutor that there was a witness who could testify to that fact, and therefore there was a reasonable basis for it to be in the prosecution version, but it doesn't go to the factual basis for the plea. The factual basis.
And in the record, I don't have the transcript, I reviewed it a while back, but in the transcript, to the best of my recollection, he never asked the court or the attorney ever asked the court, can you strike that language or it's surplus or it's immaterial. That never happened, right? It's just,
correct.
Let's go on with the plea.
Correct. He never asserted a desire not to plead or to challenge the government's evidence. He just disputed that he was speeding.
Right. He never made, there's no reference to wanting to make a motion to suppress or anything like that.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. Which would have raised the right flag.
Yeah.
And with respect to the argument that that the district court erred in rejecting his request to withdraw his plea. Once you reach the determination that the Rule 11 proceeding was properly conducted, there was absolutely no merit to his motion to withdraw his plea. The district court found that it was a knowing, intelligent, voluntary plea. He's made no assertion of actual innocence. The motions that he proposed to bring were determined by the district court to be utterly specious. And so all of the factors except the timing weigh heavily in the government's favor, and the timing only, I think, marginally weighs in the defendant's favor due to the government's concession below. So we would suggest that the district court made an entirely defensible ruling. There's no plain error in this case. We would ask the court to affirm.
Let me also ask you something as a matter of practice. When the government and defendant enter a plea agreement, of course, when there's negotiations, you can say, well, I'll enter the plea, we're not going to file the suppression. That also so happens. So,
yes.
It's not clear from the record whether that, obviously, in the record, you never see the plea discussions, but that's part of the whole plea bargaining.
Correct. And here, the record shows that the issue of filing motions was the topic of discussion between this defendant and his attorneys for approximately, certainly for 2 months and even longer, whether to file motions or to plead. And at the end of that, the defendant came in and pled. And so the record firmly supports that in doing so, the defendant knew that he was abandoning the right to file motions.
And let me also ask you, the sentence the defendant received in this case, that was the sentence recommended by the parties, correct also?
Yes. There's been no challenge to the sentence.
Okay.
Judge Lynch, did you have any further questions?
No, thank you.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you, Attorney Block. At this time, Attorney Welch, please proceed with your rebuttal by reintroducing yourself on the record to begin.
I am William Welch.
And counsel, let me ask you a very simple question. Your client is not asserting factual innocence, correct?
No, he's not.
Okay, go on.
I want to ask the court to take a look at United States versus Negron Nevaez, 403 F3rd 33, specifically at Penn State 3839. And the reason I ask for that, the court to do that, is it's what we assert is the proper way to handle when a factual dispute arises during a plea, and that either the court should have the parties take a recess.
Did the factual dispute there concern an element of the offense?
I believe that it did.
Okay.
I'm not absolutely certain. I don't want to mislead the court. But what is important there is that, well, in that case, they did come to an agreement. The defendant conceded the point. And if the defendant and the government can't reach an agreement, then the court should not take the plea at that time, and schedule an evidentiary hearing. And in order to have the witnesses come in, take the testimony, and be able to judge.
But see, that there, the dispute, if what you're saying is right, the dispute concerned an element of the offense, which is not the case here, as you've acknowledged.
Correct. But I would assert that that is the proper way to resolve.
Well, it would be if there was reason to think that him mentioning that fact and disputing it translates to a conclusion that he's asserting an interest in suppressing the evidence such that we'd have reason to doubt that he knowingly is conceding that he's giving up his right to object to the evidence. But that's just an extra inference that one would have to draw, that you don't have to draw when, if I say, do you agree that you committed this offense? And I say, well, I dispute it. That does raise a red flag. Maybe you're not actually knowingly recognizing that you agree.
Right.
It's pretty different if I just say, well, I wasn't speeding. He doesn't say, but I'd like to suppress that evidence, and if I suppress the evidence, then the case goes away. Instead, he says, I wasn't speeding, but do you realize you're giving up your right to object to the evidence? Yes, I do. Do you accept the elements of the offense? Yes, I do. It's fairly different.
It is. Yep. And that is what would have helped here, is if the record were explicit, if the record were clear. It's not.
Yeah,
I see. As a result, yep. That's our argument, is that...
Okay, let me ask you one question. Wouldn't the result, if we were to find in your client's favor, wouldn't the result be that then any Rule 11 hearing would end up becoming a potential suppression hearing or a motion to dismiss hearing or evidentiary hearing? Because that's what's going to happen if, you know, if the court were to rule in your favor, to open the doors for that in every hearing, in any possible Rule 11 hearing.
May I respond?
And then, of course, parties would need to present evidence, and that's not what a Rule 11 hearing is. It's either you accept or don't accept.
Correct. I would agree with that. What I'm just trying to argue is that in this case, if what should have happened when you begin going down that road is that the proceeding should stop. A Rule 11 proceeding should not become an evidentiary hearing. But that's what I meant to Your Honor's question. It should not turn into that kind of thing. It should simply be, you know, can you comply with 11b-3? And in this situation, because of what my client asserted, an additional step needed to be taken. Not in all cases, in this case.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That concludes argument in this case.